Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spingola Zone. It is Tuesday, January 28th, 2014. This is Deanna Spingola. This weekly program is sponsored by the American Free Press, whose website is AmericanFreePress.net. I have been a subscriber to the American Free Press and highly recommend a subscription to that newspaper. I also wish to commend the wonderful historical journal, the Barnes Review, whose website is barnesreview.org. And Barnes is spelled B-A-R-N-E-S, barnesreview.org. Please visit both websites. Support the efforts of the people who report accurate history and contemporary events. Regarding the American Free Press, all of their books, their AFP-published books, are on sale. And with that sale, you you get a one-year digital subscription to the American Free Press, America's last real newspaper. So go to the website and go down on the right-hand side, and the AmericanFreePress.net is the website that you want to go to. And on the right-hand side, just scroll down. You're going to see in on the right, in red, 40% off all AFP published books. Just click on that and it will bring you to all of the list of books that they have available. Numerous fabulous, wonderful books. And I own many of them. And yes, they have quite a nice list here. Anyway, our guest today is Friedrich Paul Berg. His website is nazigassings.com. Fritz, welcome to the program.
Hello, Deanna. I'm happy to be back.
Well, I'm happy to have you on. And just a quick note, we will be taking questions and comments from the listeners via my email, which is comment@spingola.com, or from the chat room, spingola.chechengo.com. Okay, Fritz, what's new?
Oh, well, there's actually a lot that's new, but it's hard to tell exactly where. One of the most interesting things that emerged this past year in 2013 was the announcement in the New York Times that the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum had come up with a listing of ghettos and camps, labor camps, that the Germans had established for Jews and possibly others, but I think it was almost entirely for Jews in German-occupied Europe. The number of those camps and ghettos was 42,000. Now, that is a huge, huge number. I have trouble digesting that number. It is just enormous. So the old idea, which was what Raoul Hilberg and various other so-called scholars put out, which was that there were basically six extermination camps and a few ghettos, which were basically set up to feed Jews or bring Jews together so that they could be fed toward the concentration camps and then exterminated there, really just doesn't hold up very well. Some of these camps that the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum is now talking about are far to the east. In fact, some of them were even, at least one of them, was east of Stalingrad.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, there's a map giving the locations of many of these camps, and it's on my website, www.nazigassings.com. And everybody can look at it there or in any number of other locations. And you can see how widely distributed these ghettos and labor camps were for Jews and possibly others, but I think they were primarily for Jews, according to what I've seen of this new revised story from the Jews themselves. So that is just a mind-blowing bit of rather new information, and it'll be years, I suppose, before it's all been much more thoroughly digested. I think a lot of these camps came up in the survivors or Holocaust survivors' personal accounts, which are available also. So that's basically the newest, most startling thing of all that I can think of at this time.
And those camps, those 42,000 camps, all are, well, they're, none of them are in Germany. Most of them are in Poland,
right,
according to the red dots. And when I first read that story earlier this year, I thought, well, they must be talking about individual Jewish homes. And we know for a fact that many of the Jews, you know, people think that the Germans rounded up every single Jew in Europe and threw them into a camp. That is just not true. So I assumed that they must be counting all of the Jewish homes of the people who were not in the regular camps. It's just kind of an amazing thing.
Well, that's one of the questions that remains. Many questions remain. But one thing is very clear. The Jews were widely distributed in the early years of the war in Russia in order to remove them from German-occupied Europe,
right,
what is traditionally Europe anyway. And so that was the purpose. There was plenty of work near the front and in the various locations within the Ukraine and Belarusia and so forth. There was lots of work always repairing roads, repairing trains, repairing railroad tracks, repairing military equipment, repairing clothing, making new clothing. There was an enormous amount of work. So to have exterminated these people would not have been very helpful to the German war effort. They could be put to work, and there was plenty of it.
Sure.
As the war changed, however, as Germany was being pushed back, pushed to the west, there was the question what to do with these Jews. Should they just be left where they were to be, quote, liberated by the Soviet forces? Well, no doubt many Jews were supposedly liberated by the Soviets, but I suspect also, and this is one of the little secrets that has to be unraveled, I suspect that large numbers of Jews were simply massacred by the Soviets as the Soviets came to these various camps and ghettos and found these German-speaking Jews, which many of them were for sure. And, they all had excuses, they all hated Hitler and so forth, but the Russians, the Soviets, let's say, had some nasty habits, and many Jews, I'm sure, were simply massacred. We don't know for sure, but we do know that the Jews in Auschwitz, for example, were deathly afraid of being liberated by the Russians. And Elie Wiesel was one of those people. Elie Wiesel, for me, is a kind of poster child of the Holocaust hoax. He himself didn't hang around for the supposed liberation of Auschwitz. I doubt if he ever goes to these annual celebrations in Auschwitz, you know, where they celebrate the liberation of Auschwitz by Soviet forces. I don't think he's ever been there. I'm pretty sure he's not there today. This is the day of liberation because he skedaddled westward with the Germans. And he explains that all very, very clearly for everyone to read in his famous book, Night, for which he seems to have gotten the Nobel Peace Prize. I'm not sure what all the reasons were for him getting the Nobel Peace Prize, but
to give him credibility, I think.
Yeah,
that's
whatever.
The only thing those
but in that book,
before.
But in the book, on page 78, in the paperback version, which is the most widely sold version, he says for late January, I don't know exactly what date this would be, it's not really spelled out, but he says, talking about his father and himself at that point, he says, the choice was in our hands. For once we could decide our fate for ourselves. Now, let me add here, the Russians were coming. Everybody knew that. They were only a day or two from taking over the camp, and the Germans were retreating. He continues, we both could stay in the hospital where I could, thanks to my doctor, get him entered as a patient or nurse, or else we could follow the others. Well, what shall we do?
Let me stop you right there.
Okay.
There was a hospital for sick people at Auschwitz.
More than one.
Yes. There was an infirmary, a hospital,
yes.
There were
very large buildings that were not just used as hospitals, but which were actually specialized in different kinds of illnesses. If you had an eye illness, like trachoma, you would go to one building. And if you had a lung disease, you would go to another building. If you had any number of other diseases, you'd go to completely separate buildings. So at Auschwitz, at the main camp in particular, there was a very well-organized healthcare system to which Ellie went for an operation on his foot by a Jewish doctor, of all people. So this is already one of the realities of Auschwitz that is totally suppressed in all the propaganda. Why would one bother with hospitalization for Jews who got sick? You know, it was all the more reason to just get rid of them, supposedly, according to what we've been told. Anyway, he asks his father, I'll continue here from page 78, or else we could follow the others. Well, what shall we do, father? He was silent. Let's be evacuated with the others, I told him. It was not a question of reasoning. Now I'm switching to another book by Primo Levi, which actually says almost the exact same story, except that Primo Levi decided to stay in Auschwitz rather than follow the others on foot in the middle of a bitter cold winter to the next railroad station that was still functioning, which was Gleiwitz, and then get on a train and go west with the Germans, with the very same people who had supposedly been murdering millions of Jews, either in Auschwitz itself or in other camps. It's just incredible, but that's what we're told. The book Night is like a Bible. Everybody has a copy somewhere on their shelves, but hardly anyone ever reads it.
Well, you know what? You know what, Fritz? I have a signed copy, and I received it from the very hands of Elie Wiesel.
Oh my goodness. But did you actually read it?
I did. I actually read it.
All right.
I went to a lecture that he gave. I mean, I live fairly close to Skokie, and which is very high population of Jews.
Right.
And it was actually it was in a it wasn't in a synagogue, although it might have been. I can't remember. I went with a friend and listened to his lecture and chatted with him thereafter. I think this was in about 1988. It was when I still believed that the Holocaust was legitimate.
Okay.
And because I was pretty naive. And but anyway, I purchased the book, and he signed it and oogled me a little bit, and, you know, because that's what Jews do. I have found in working with so many that they always have an eye for the women,
especially Gentile women, because Jewish women are so ugly.
Well, some of them are pretty ugly, but some of them are pretty good looking.
Some are, but
right.
Every Jewish male knows that the goal is to get a nice looking Shiksa, a Gentile girl, rather than the girl from the synagogue. But anyway, let me go a little further. I always bring up this act of collaboration from Elie Wiesel, because that's what it was. When he went west with the Nazis into Germany, it was to work for the German war effort. The Germans were not simply going to put him up in a guest house to sit out the war. They were going to put him to work, and every Jew knew that. That was the purpose of Auschwitz to begin with, to get Jews cleaned up, medically checked, and get them ready to go to work inside Germany at any number of factories and help with the German war effort to defend Hitler and the Third Reich. Everybody knew that, including Elie. And when I bring this up, they always try to counter by suggesting that he was terrified at being killed perhaps at the last day by the retreating SS and things like that. But he actually says a bit earlier in the text, "As for me, I was not thinking about death, but I did not want to be separated from my father." So he says himself that he was not worried about any rumors that they would all be killed at the last moment or anything like that. He recounts some stories that were told about what might happen and so forth, but he basically ignored that. He was not afraid of death, and he tells us that himself. So when he went with the Germans and in effect collaborated with the Nazis, he did it rather willingly. He could have hung around, just sat on his butt in Auschwitz and waited for the Russians to come, but he didn't want to. Many Jews, I'm sure, probably most of them, were very much afraid of the Russians, even though many Jews had risen to the highest positions within the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was a communist state. Many Jews had been communists all along anyway. They should have been especially happy that the Soviet forces were coming within days at most to Auschwitz, but they, in the vast majority of cases, chose to go west and make this very arduous trek at night in the middle of winter to Gleiwitz and then to then onto railroad trains to the west. So the story that really is under the surface is a very different story, a radically different story from all the filthy propaganda we're given constantly, especially on days like today.
Oh, yes. Yes, yesterday and today, it's a big commemoration, and certainly every day seems to be a day where they talk about the Holocaust, particularly in the New York Times and other newspapers. And, of course, we have compulsory Holocaust education in most of the schools in America, which was started early on in five different states. But a lot of the Jews, as you mentioned, were already moved to the east, and in fact, they had their own autonomous region called Bir Bijan, which was a Jewish sanctuary that allowed them to be safe from any area that the Germans occupied.
Okay, that's new to me. I don't doubt it. It's completely new to me, though. But I'm sure that was entirely within the well-known program that Jews knew about themselves.
Sure.
And that's very different, totally different from this extermination hoax that we've been given.
Absolutely. Now, on your website, you have a very interesting website. Right at the top, you have a photo of Adolf Hitler, an image of Adolf Hitler. And and you say, Nazi gassings never happened. And you have a picture right behind the image of Hitler of a body with some very, very deep red, cherry red coloring. Can you explain that to the to the audience, the listening audience, about what that represents, that red coloring on this body?
That red coloring is a typical indication of carbon monoxide poisoning. And you can find it explained in medical literature going back for more than 100 years. Because of the automobile and gasoline engines, people were dying by the thousands every year in the United States and many other countries just from the exhaust from the gasoline engines in their cars and trucks. And so it became very, you know, a repeat kind of emergency problem that medical specialists faced rather routinely. And in that literature, you can see again and again, it's spelled out that the bodies of people who died from carbon monoxide poisoning were bright cherry red. And that is a well-known characteristic of carbon monoxide poisoning. Now, why is it important as far as the Holocaust hoax is concerned? It is because, according to the mythology, which even people like David Irving seem to have embraced, the vast majority of gassing victims were supposedly killed with carbon monoxide. It used to be claimed they were killed with diesel exhaust, but I've shown, I think rather persuasively, that diesel exhaust contains hardly any carbon monoxide. But gasoline engine exhaust contains a lot of carbon monoxide. And if you die from gasoline engine exhaust, almost certainly your body will be bright cherry red, at least in a large part of the body. And that shows itself very clearly at the time of autopsy or whenever the body is naked. Supposedly, in places like Treblinka, Belzec, and Sobibor, the bodies were piled up by the thousands naked for literally everyone in the area to see. And yet, and this is the most stunning thing, none, absolutely none of the self-described eyewitnesses to those piles of bodies or to the gassings themselves or who were involved in supposedly removing the bodies, not one of those self-proclaimed eyewitnesses ever spoke of the bodies being bright cherry red or pink or anything remotely close to that. Instead, we get the craziest kind of claims. Oh, the bodies were blue. Oh, the bodies were yellow. Oh, the bodies were this or that or gray or had no coloration whatsoever different from other corpses. It undermines the entire gassing story as far as camps like Treblinka, Belzec, Sobibor, and even Kelno. There was only one, well, the Soviets, interestingly enough, made claims about gas vans, claiming that the Germans used gas vans to kill Soviet citizens, not necessarily Jews, but Soviet citizens. And in their trials that were, of course, farces in every sense, they claimed that their doctors saw reddish coloring on the corpses. But in the Western countries, or like Poland, where gassings were on a vast scale in the camps themselves, there is no eyewitness testimony of anything like that. There's one exception, Sachsenhausen, which was a different camp, and which was occupied at the end of the war by the Russians, where a German doctor, a forensic pathologist, claimed that some Russian prisoners who had been gassed were red. But for Treblinka, Belzec, Sobibor, and Kelno, there was no such claim whatsoever. Instead, you get all kinds of other colors. And this is, to my mind, at least, a clear indication that all of these eyewitnesses or self-described eyewitnesses lied, and got away with it and had their lies enshrined in the Holocaust propaganda.
Indeed. Now, you brought up gassings with carbon monoxide. What about the cyclone B?
Well, cyanide also generally causes a red or possibly a purplish discoloration of the corpse. And cyanide, of course, is used in American execution chambers to execute convicted murderers and people like that. And in those cases, we see again and again in the descriptions of the gassings that the victim or prisoner turns red quite often. Not in all cases, as far as we can tell from eyewitness accounts, but in many cases, the prisoner turns red at the time of gassing. There was I give you one example here. A guy, I think his name was Ricky Lee Sanderson. When he was executed, he was actually turning red in front of all the witnesses. And just about, maybe 2 years ago, a guy right here in Phoenix, Arizona, killed himself in the courtroom by taking some cyanide capsules, and it was photographed, it was videoed, and as he was dying, and you could see that he was actually turning red. And a newspaper reporter who was present said clearly he was turning red at the very time after he was dying. Let's see, I have the actual discussion here somewhere, if I can find it. It's on my website. No, I don't seem to be able to find it, I'm sorry to say. But it is there if one looks for it.
Sure. Now, so, you have a couple of people here, LeGrand, LeGrand and also Jimmy Lee Gray, and you say that Jimmy Lee Gray died in something like, 18 minutes?
Right.
And that this other gentleman, LeGrand, died in 18 minutes, and Jimmy Lee died in something more than 8 minutes. But apparently the Germans were very, very efficient, and they could kill a couple thousand people in a room in just 5 minutes.
And in fact,
and everybody died at the very same minute, apparently.
Well, this is another one of the absurdities of the Holocaust hoax. The actual first story that I think is significant about cyanide gassings came from two guys named Wetzler and Virba. They had supposedly seen the gassings, and it took only 3 minutes to kill 2,000 Jews at one time. 3 minutes.
Okay.
And that story was then changed as time went on. It became like 10 minutes and then 20 minutes. So it grew much longer as people had a little more time to think about this story. But
kind of like Pinocchio's nose, right?
Like Pinocchio's nose, whatever. My guess is that anything like a gassing of 2,000 people would have taken a very, very long time to kill everyone. You know, sure, some people might die very quickly, but I make a joke sometimes about the fact that the little smart-aleck Jewish kid who hides under his dying or dead Uncle Moishe and Aunt Sarah could probably survive a very long gassing and walk out the door afterwards and, you know, act up and make a fuss about what he had endured at the hands of these fiendish people. So these gas chambers were very, very badly designed and operated according to the Holocaust story we're given. They didn't even have the fans running during the actual killing phase. The fans supposedly were only turned on afterward. After everybody was dead, then the fans would be turned on. And this itself is a major absurdity as far as the Holocaust hoax is concerned, because you would have wanted to have the circulation fan or blower operating during the killing phase itself so that you could disperse the cyanide throughout the entire gas chamber and not just to anybody who happened to be near the Zyklon B granules. Anyway, that's a little bit technical. I explain it at some length on the CODO discussion forum, and if people are interested, they should look at some of the comments I've made in the last few days. But it's a major weakness in the story.
Sure. Well, in fact, they didn't use Zyklon B to kill people. And those rooms that they suggest or claim are gas chambers were redesigned at Auschwitz after the Soviets liberated Auschwitz on January 27, 1945. They redesigned it. They built a chimney. And then they claimed, oh, these are the gas chambers, when in fact the one gas chamber has a door that opens inward, has windows. I mean, it's just preposterous to even suggest that anybody could have used that room to gas anybody because it wasn't even airtight. And when Fred Leuchter went to Auschwitz, it was preposterous to even suggest these things. And so tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I agree generally with what you've said. I want to make an additional point. As time goes on, the story unravels in large part because of modern technology. The issue of the color of corpses is just one example. Years ago, just 10 or 15 years ago, if one wanted to find color pictures of corpses, it was a tough struggle. I have some very expensive forensic pathology textbooks from just maybe 15 years ago that have either no color pictures or hardly any color pictures at all. And the color pictures that are in those books were of very, very poor quality because one had to use color film in those days. The photographers were probably medical doctors who were not particularly skilled. The color printing was problematic. But today, with digital photography and the internet, one can achieve fantastic color quality, accuracy especially, and one can see clearly the way the corpses actually appear and the way an actual observer would see them. And that's why that one picture on my logo for my website is very, very important, and it was very rare or very fortuitous when it appeared, because I had other pictures taken from years earlier that just weren't as good. But today, as I said, with digital photography and the internet, things have changed. Another type... Hello?
That's okay.
Okay. There's another major feature where color is enormously important. The walls of the delousing stations at Birkenau today still, I believe, show very intense bluish staining on the interior walls and on the exterior walls. Fred Leuchter photographed these, and other people have been there and photographed those walls. And Guillermo Rudolph was there, and I was there. We all made our own photographs. We all used color film, Kodachrome or Ektachrome or something like that. And even with all of that technology, in those days, one could not get really accurate, detailed, or intense colors that matched what one actually saw on those walls. I was there, and I was stunned right away by how intense that blue coloring was. It's comparable to the color in the artist's pigment Prussian blue. It's a very intense blue, almost electric, one could say. And when you see it, you know that that is either Prussian blue or some other very intense blue. It's not, you know, some ordinary stain that arises from a mere swatch on some bricks or anything like that. It's very intense, and you cannot even match it at all with the old color films. But today, I dare say, if I could go to Auschwitz again, and Birkenau especially, and photograph those stains with a good digital camera, I could capture it. And that would be very persuasive. But I suspect by now, the Polish government and the museum authorities have played games with those examples of blue staining, so we may never see that again. But it was absolutely stunning to see that. And for me, it was the coup de grace as far as the Holocaust hoax was concerned, because you saw that intense blue staining at the delousing stations where nobody was supposedly killed, where the cyanide was only used to kill lice and clean up clothing, and at the alleged gas chambers where people were supposedly killed by the thousands every day practically with cyanide, you saw no staining whatsoever anywhere, and no one ever has. They don't even pretend that there ever was any visible blue staining at those gas chambers. So that in itself is a major fact which undermines the Holocaust hoax.
Right. Well, you have on your website, on the right-hand side of your website, you have several reasons, simple reasons for rejecting the Holocaust hoax. And people can easily go to those reasons. You've downsized the reasons. You have 14 reasons. And at one point in time when we did a radio program, you had even eliminated some of those reasons and given us, just a few reasons an abbreviated list. But you have 14 reasons why one should doubt the Holocaust. Do you want to talk about
right.
those reasons?
Well, I'm trying to get it down to an even smaller number. I'm trying to make it more concise. The most
kind of the cliff note reasons?
Yeah, something like that. You know, the moment you go into lengthy explanations, you lose a large chunk of any audience. It's a sad fact of life. People have very short attention spans. They want to flip on their cell phones or iPhones and look at a video game or something like that. But number one reason for doubting the Holocaust is that there are no autopsy reports that show that even one person was ever killed in any of the German concentration camps. And there were autopsies performed precisely to find proof or any kind of evidence of gassings.
Now, were there 1,000 autopsies performed?
There were well over 1,000 performed just by one doctor, one American doctor, Charles P. Larson. I'm sure the British performed autopsies as well, although we don't have any strong evidence of that. But one could see very quickly with the Bergen-Belsen story that the British quickly abandoned all claims that people had been gassed at Bergen-Belsen. At the Bergen-Belsen trial, which was conducted by the British never claimed that anyone was gassed to death at Bergen-Belsen. And regarding Dachau and other camps that came under control of British, American, or French military forces, there are no claims, even in those days, that that people were killed in gas chambers. All those gas chamber murder claims were totally dropped. But at the Bergen-Belsen trial, they insisted that people had been gassed, but not at Bergen-Belsen, but at Auschwitz, which was under Soviet occupation at that time. Now, what was the basis for those claims? Well, it was Jewish liars like Ada Bimko, who was the star witness for the prosecution at the Bergen-Belsen trial. She was fat, So she clearly had not been a victim of any kind of starvation program. She was fat and highly talkative, and oh, she couldn't condemn the Germans badly enough for what they had supposedly done, not at Bergen-Belsen, but at Auschwitz. So what we see, I think, and I hope it's clear, is that although there were lots of dead bodies at Bergen-Belsen, no one claims that any of those bodies had anything to do with gassing. No one seriously claims that this or that body was a victim of a gas chamber. But those bodies are still wonderful propaganda for people who want to accuse the Germans of gassing people to death at a totally different camp. It's a very, very strange game, a kind of bait and switch. You get people to believe in gas chambers on the basis of pictures of corpses of people who didn't die and in gas chambers at a totally different location. Now, what did those people die from in Bergen-Belsen? They died from disease. They died especially from typhus and some other diseases, but typhus was the worst. And those deaths were to a great extent the result of the bombing of the power plant nearby, near to Bergen-Belsen, so that the prisoners or people in the camp who had high fevers from typhus, they couldn't get clean water to rehydrate their systems. So they became skinnier and skinnier and skinnier and eventually died from any number of complications that arose under those circumstances. I had something similar about 12 years ago when I had cancer. I underwent very severe fevers of over 104 degrees. And when you have a fever like that, you perspire like crazy. I'm sure I lost several pounds every time I went through one of those fever spells. And I lost several pounds just from the water perspiring out of my system. Eventually, afterward, I would always drink a lot of water and rehydrate. But if you didn't have fresh water and healthy, clean water available, you dehydrated. You gradually were reduced to literally skin and bone. And that's what happened at Bergen-Belsen and other camps as well because of the British and American bombing and strafing of civilian targets. The Germans hadn't done anything to cause that deliberately at all. If the British had really wanted to prosecute and punish the people responsible for those horrors at Bergen-Belsen, all they had to do was look at themselves and then take a gun and blow their brains out. That would have been the right thing to do.
Sure. Now, Stephen Jobs, you have pictures of Stephen Jobs. You also have a picture of Robin Gibb from the Bee Gees. And what concentration camp were they in?
They weren't in any concentration camp, of course. They were here in the United States of America. They were extremely wealthy, successful individuals. They had some of the best care, if not the very best of the best care available to them in the entire world. And yet you can clearly see that Steve Jobs, for well over a year before he actually died, literally looked like he had just gotten out of Bergen-Belsen. He was literally skin and bone. He looked horrible. But, he was kept alive, but he eventually died. Now, that actually happens all the time in America. I've always made this point, and people don't want to believe it, but people die in such a condition all the time, every day in this country, in all the major hospitals of the country, all the time. But if you keep a person wrapped up in a nice bed sheet or in the pajamas, it's not very noticeable in most cases. But people who die of cancer or AIDS or any number of very contagious, slow acting diseases are literally reduced to skin and bone before they pass on. And Undertaker, he tries to puff everybody up. There are all kinds of tricks they use, cotton in the cheeks and fluid in the body, and all kinds of tricks are done so that poor Harry or Mary looks almost as good as she ever did in her entire life when she's laying there in the casket in the funeral parlor. But the reality is rather different. It's not a pleasant subject, but, you know, we're not talking about a pleasant subject to begin with.
Exactly. Now, you mentioned Kodo, which is a fabulous site and certainly deserves our support. And you have several links to Kodo. And I've had Mr. Smith on my program. He's delightful. He's just so funny. When I read his Holocaust, his book, talking about how he became a Holocaust denier, I mean, it was really so well written. I mean, he writes, he's got a very distinct way of writing, but you just have to laugh because it's so funny. I mean, he's really funny.
Well, I think humor is very important, and I try to be humorous myself sometimes. It's a very powerful tool. One of the things that one can achieve when one writes humorously and writes well is to put many issues and arguments and facts together very, very quickly and succinctly. One can use the spaces, the pauses to help convey the message. And I hope I can master that at some point. I do try, and sometimes I'm successful, I think, but it's a special art that I have to work on, and I think we all should try. The Holocaust story really is something well worth poking fun at. I try with little gimmicks I come up with. I'm a great believer in things like Holocaust memorial ashtrays, and I think we should promote them in all public places so that people will always remember the Holocaust. As they put cigarettes and cigar butts in an ashtray, it should remind everybody about the sufferings of the Jews in the so-called Holocaust, and maybe teach people about fire prevention and things like that. Anyway, there's an awful lot to be said for humor. Forresten uses it. There is a comedian in France who has poked fun at the Jewish mythology, and I wish him well. Forresten has actually worked with him, as I understand, and I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, one of the things that Bradley R. Smith wrote is called The Man Who Saw His Own Liver. Now, who would ever come up with a name like that? I mean, that's a book that just begs to be read.
Yeah, right. I'm reading now, actually, Sinclair Lewis's book. I think it's Main Street, uh-huh. And he shows with his humor and wit some of the craziness of American society, a lot of craziness. It was a very popular book, and I suppose it had some impact as well. So maybe I can learn something from that.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go back to your cliff notes on why we should not accept the Holocaust. You talked about the two photos. And then right beneath that, you talk about, was FDR starved or tortured?
Yes, exactly. Well, FDR, when he was in Yalta at this big conference with Churchill and Stalin, already looked like he had been in Bergen-Belsen. And you can look at those pictures. He was a very sick man. His face was deeply drawn, and it was obvious he was sick, but was it because someone was torturing him? Of course not. So that's just one more bit of evidence in support mm-hmm. of what I'm saying.
Sure. And he did manage to make it home and die in the arms of his lover, so.
Okay, that may be. Yeah.
Yeah, yep. Okay, there were no German documents to identify any gassing victims. That's number
exactly.
three.
Exactly. Okay. Right. Right. One of the big lies, and I should talk about this, is lie that's used to support the Holocaust hoax. And it's the lie that there is some huge body of evidence that is just staggeringly huge to support the Holocaust claims. And there's nothing like that at all. Years ago, I went to the National Archives to hear a talk by the chief archivist. His name escapes me at the moment, but he was Jewish, and he admitted right away in his talk that, contrary to popular belief, the evidence for the Holocaust is very, very minimal. And he had a shoebox next to him, and he said, it all fits in here. And one of the things he had was a statement from Kurt Gerstein, in which Gerstein supposedly describes a mass gassing that he, Gerstein, had witnessed either at Belzec or Treblinka. Now, the Gerstein statement is one of the cornerstones of the Holocaust hoax, and it is just plain crazy. Gerstein claimed, for example, that diesel engines were used, that it was the exhaust from the diesel engines that killed the Jews, and that the Jews were blue, wet with sweat and urine at the time of death, and that he, Gerstein, had witnessed it all with a stopwatch in his hand, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it's a lengthy statement, but it's rubbish. It's garbage. And there's nothing any better than that. That is the extent of it. Now, there were the bulk of the real evidence, or the strongest evidence, consists of statements from so-called eyewitnesses. All of the eyewitnesses are liars. The Jews, of course, lied because they wanted to. They wanted to condemn the Germans as much as possible, and they did with some success. But there were other so-called eyewitness statements from Germans. The dirty little secret is that the Germans were tortured. The worst statement came from Rudolf Höss, who had been commandant of Auschwitz, and he made a lengthy, lengthy statement, even a book, but he had been tortured for 3 days before he made his first statement, with some reluctance apparently, because he had been tortured brutally by a Jewish sergeant in the British Army, a guy
named Bernard Clark.
Bernard Clark, exactly, and it was only clear years later from Clark's own statement, no relation to Veronica Clark, I'm sure, that he had done that, and he was, in fact, rather proud of it. He made no secret of it whatsoever. So that explains, I think, all of the German statements on this subject. They were tortured, and it's easy to do. It's easy enough to understand that the United States, to its great shame, is doing that today with prisoners from Afghanistan, probably at this very moment. You know, Americans should really hang their heads in shame for what they did during World War II and what they're continuing to do to this very day.
Oh, but we're exclusive. America has, we're very exclusive in, and we just,
I know. That is so outrageous. The more I think about it, the more ashamed I am to be living in this country and to having anything to do with this country. I'm becoming more and more anti-American, and I mean this very seriously. I don't hope anything really horrible is coming, but I think it will, because we're so stupid and we're so vile as a people.
Indeed. Last year, at the middle of last year, talking about records, they found, the official United States Holocaust Memorial Museum announced that they had discovered, unearthed Alfred Rosenberg's diary. And the way that they made it sound, it was as if, oh, we've got the proof here. Wait till we just go through this diary and these papers, when in fact, it was Jackson, Robert Jackson, that brought the thing back, along with a lot of other things. He actually stole, commandeered a lot of papers from Nuremberg, where he was the Chief Justice for the Americans over there, and he brought back a lot of the stuff to use in his research, and then he died, and apparently his secretary then took possession of this diary. But anyway, the Holocaust Museum made a big to-do about having found this diary.
Right, and it contained essentially nothing.
Nothing.
incriminating whatsoever. And the same thing is going on today with regard to Himmler's personal correspondence, which is now being held at the Yad Vashem in Israel and so forth. It's been around for several decades already, it seems, as I recall, in the hands of the Israelis. They haven't found anything worth talking about, otherwise I'm sure they would have told the whole world years ago, oh, here Himmler is admitting to his girlfriend or fiancé, whatever, that yes, we're getting rid of those Jews in those wonderful gas chambers, blah, blah, blah. Nothing of the sort. Nothing of the sort is found.
Sure.
All the evidence that emerges as time goes on undermines the Holocaust hoax more and more and more and more. And yet, the Jews keep making more and more propaganda. How many more movies are we going to see just within this next year on the so-called Holocaust? It's incredible. It's incredible. The United States should really change its name. This is not the United States of America. This really is the Jew-United States of America. And we could do such a wonderful job if we simply took all those Israeli Jews, brought them here to the United States. We could save probably several trillion dollars that we're now throwing away on these foolish wars in the Middle East to essentially make Israel more secure. Just bring the Jews to the United States. Give them a huge plot of land in West Texas or somewhere. I mean, we do have a lot of land that could be made available to the Jews for next to nothing, and in the process we would save trillions of dollars that are being wasted fighting people who simply want to get their land back.
Sure. Well, I have some friends in Texas. I don't know that I'd want to do that to them.
Well, there are parts of Texas that are pretty remote. You know, they might have oil underground, but aside from that, I don't know why anybody would want to live in those areas. Anyway,
sure.
Montana has a lot of empty space also. East Montana is for the birds also.
Sure. Well, getting back to the Alfred Rosenberg diary. Now, if Jackson brought all of these records back, honestly, if the records at that time had anything significant in them, they wouldn't have had to torture the Germans to extract testimonies or confessions out of them. They would have just used the documents. But the fact is, there was nothing in the documents then, and guess what? There's nothing in the documents now.
There's nothing there. So you just torture the prisoner to get a confession. If you get a confession out of him, you don't need documents. You know, if you can beat the crap out of him so that he stands up in the courtroom and politely says, oh, yes, I killed 2.5 million Jews. Oh, well, what's better than that, right?
Sure. Well, they also said, okay, if you do not confess, if you do not tell us what happened here at Auschwitz, your family is not going to get their ration certificates.
Exactly,
and
of course.
And they will die. And the other thing that they did, and I hate to bring this up, but it is kind of sensitive. Well, they... they used their boots on his...
Right, on the testicles of the men.
Okay, you can say it. You go ahead.
Yeah, no. I mean, men know that. You know, when you're in prison and someone wants to make life rough for you as a man, that's one of the first things they do. You know, and it's extremely painful. And that's why it's done. But there are all kinds of other dirty tricks that are done as well. You just keep a person awake constantly for 3 or 4 days, he will literally go out of his mind. And that was done as well. Any dirty trick you can dream of, they were pulling on even low-rank members of the SS in order to make their lives as miserable as possible because they felt so righteous and pure of themselves. If they had really wanted to look at what evil was like, all they had to do was look into any mirror.
Exactly. Now, you mentioned Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, and I hate to admit this, but I visited that museum. It was just part of the tour that I was on, and they set it up very, very, it was an emotional thing. It was like walking into a cathedral. The lighting was very low, very dimly lit, and they had all this scrolling names of all the supposed victims, miniature walk-in, that's what you saw. And there were no guards or anything. There were no one there to ask questions of. You could simply press a button and find out what it was you were looking at. But it was set up like some sort of a mausoleum. And like I say, very emotional. And people were sad, and that's what they play upon. They use the victim card, the emotion card, and when you talk about all these movies, and I think there's been about 500 movies made about the Holocaust, they are all designed to get us emotionally involved with this hoax.
Exactly. I don't even call it the Holocaust. I call it the Holocaust hoax, and one should, I think, use that terminology whenever possible so that whoever listens knows that you are a Holocaust revisionist to begin with. But anyway, that's my this is the new religion, you know.
Sure.
All the other religion, you can say anything you want about Christians or Muslims, at least in the United States, or Mormons, they're crooks, thieves, what have you. Try to say something like that about Jews. Oh, my goodness, you're going to be another Tom Perkins who, you know, despite being a multimillionaire, had to eat crow and literally get on his knees almost because he had compared the Kristallnacht to what is being done to the rich people in this country. Oh my goodness, how he spoke of the Jews and the Holocaust without the kind of reverence that is demanded by the Jews today. So he had to apologize, and that's essentially what he did. Now, when people with such wealth are reduced like that, that tells you the kind of insane state we have in this country. In Germany, it's not any better, you know, but it's actually worse. You're literally ruined if you are identified as a Holocaust denier or quibbler even. And I don't know where this is all going to end, but it's not good. It's going to end sometime in a terrible war. I suspect it will be a nuclear world war in order to help keep this Jewish religion alive indefinitely.
Sure. Well, they're trying to make – there's a London Declaration on combating anti-Semitism. I mean, they're doing this worldwide. And, of course, George W. Bush signed the act regarding anti-Semitism. I can't remember the date that he signed that, probably in 2005, really making it against the law. It's just simply that they have not imposed the law. They've signed it, they just haven't imposed it. And so it's these things are coming. Now, you have had debates, you have challenged many people to debate you about the Holocaust, and how has that gone for you?
Well, the only person who's really accepted any of my challenges has been Roberto Muhlenkamp, and I have to give the guy a lot of credit. At least he stood up and debated me twice on your show. I've also challenged David Irving just in the last 2 weeks, and I did get an answer from him. It's a it's sort of a odd answer. He claims he's writing the book about Himmler, and I'll just have to wait until after that book is finished before he and I can have any debate. He didn't really say he would debate me. He didn't say he wouldn't. We'll just have to wait and see. But I think challenging these people is very useful. It helps to show, for example, that at least some of us are willing to debate these characters and debate anyone. I'll debate Elie Wiesel, you know, if he would ever dare to stand up to me.
Sure.
But he won't. He won't. You know yourself, since you actually contacted some Jewish Holocaust survivors at my request about a debate, and their answer is that we do not debate Holocaust deniers, okay?
Right.
As a matter of principle. They're very cowardly people, but, you know, they're up on their high horses and can get away with that kind of behavior because they are so perfect and wonderful that merely demeaning themselves by debating such terrible people as myself would be outrageous also. So they don't do that.
Well, the other thing is, it's fine. They want an audience that they can talk to and give them emotional kinds of stories, survivor-type stories, stories about how they swallowed diamonds or some other nonsense. But they don't want anybody to ask any questions that might reveal some of the discrepancies in their story. And so it's fine for them to have the audience, to have everybody just, you know, purchasing their books, like with the incident with Elie Wiesel. That's all fine and good. But when you really challenge them and say, okay, we want to know the facts. Tell us exactly about this particular incident. And that is when they will say, we just don't do that because, after all, the Holocaust is a well-known fact, and why would we debate something that's well-known to be the truth?
Right. That would be like demeaning themselves. They're above all that sort of thing.
Sure.
And my take on all these Holocaust survivors is that they are living proof that the Holocaust is a hoax, but it's also they are living proof of the simple fact that the Germans never tried to kill them in the first place. If the Germans had ever tried to kill Elie Wiesel, they certainly would have been able to. He would have been dead. But we are actually given this insane story that the Jews somehow resisted all these attempts by the Germans to kill them, at least many of them, right? They somehow had their belief in God was so strong, and their belief in their cause or their community and their friends and so forth all helped them resist all these countless efforts by the Germans to kill them. It's absolutely insane, but people are so brainwashed that they think they're getting a meaningful story. The fact is, the Germans kept these people alive, fed them, gave them clothing, medical attention, shelter, and protected them as best they could in the very worst months of World War II. The last months of the war were terrible for everybody on German territory. There was like continuous bombing and strafing by American bombers and fighter planes of every sort. If the Germans had wanted to exterminate these people or wanted to see them killed, all they would have had to do was keep them out in the open in a fenced-in field somewhere. The American fighter planes would have come and killed them all. And in fact, the big killer of Jews in the concentration camps at the end of the war was American and British bombing and strafing of civilian targets. That's, you know, one of those inconvenient facts that is sort of buried in all of this Holocaust propaganda, but it's the reality. So, you know, the truth about all of this is radically different from the filth that we're being given constantly, every day in this crazy country that we have.
Sure. Now, what would you say to a gentleman, to an individual who would say, well, Hitler put the Jews in the camps in order to save them, and that he is the one that started the wars, and that he was really working for the Rothschilds, and that he was really the bad guy in all of this.
Well,
what would you say to that?
That's pretty silly. Hitler certainly was not that interested in saving the Jews. He wanted to treat them properly, or fairly, but he certainly wasn't out to make them any richer than they already were before he came to power. There's all kinds of crazy speculation like that, and I'm no expert on those stories. I don't believe them for an instant.
Okay.
He wanted the Jews out of Germany, and the great success Jews have in this country with Holocaust propaganda and countless lies about what the Germans supposedly did to them and what is really happening in the Middle East today, they show again and again that when Hitler tried to get them out of Germany forever and ever, he had the right idea. The idea to have kept the Jews in Germany to, you know, run Germany as they had earlier was inconceivable. And all they are proving is that basically Hitler was quite right to try to expel them, to put them in concentration camps, and get them the heck out of Germany for good.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one thing they prove with all of their Holocaust propaganda.
And it certainly wasn't the first time that Germany had suggested it, and it was certainly not the first time that other countries had not expelled them over a period of several centuries. I mean,
right.
Wasn't it 79 countries expelled them 109 times?
Let me tell you a little secret. It's very quick. Judaism is racism. Three words, easy to remember. Judaism is racism. Everybody in the world has been convinced over the last half century that racism is terrible against blacks, against Muslims, against Chinese, against what have you, against Russians, against Germans, whatever. Racism is bad, and I agree, racism is bad. But Jewish racism is protected. It's condoned. It's subsidized. It's given tax exemption again and again. The Israeli expansion into the West Bank is paid for largely by money from tax-exempt Jewish organizations here in the United States. And no one in Congress would dare to stand up and say, my goodness, we ought to cut off that tax-exempt funding of those settlements. No one. Everybody is afraid of telling the truth about Jewish racism. What else is Judaism? It's nothing else. Judaism is racism. And we ought to spell it out as simply as that and remind everybody, Judaism is racism.
Exactly.
The Old Testament is a racist document. Judaism is genocidal racism directed against the entire world, and they're getting away with it.
Do you remember several years ago, well, not too many years ago, but the 300 people, members of Congress, who signed a pledge, a vow, that they would support Israel, and they sent this letter to the then Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. And, I mean, that is the height of treachery to me.
Right.
That they would do this. They're supposed to be representing the United States, the citizens of the United States. What the heck are they signing a vow to pledge their support for Israel? What the heck is that all about?
Well, they've taken over our country. You know, that's the reality. They are the most powerful ethnic group on the planet. You know, a billion Chinese don't have anything near that kind of influence on world events. And I'm afraid very soon that chaos that we see right now in the Middle East is going to bring about a nuclear world war that will, I'm afraid, also be the end of life on this planet as we know it. I hope I'm wrong. Maybe I am, but I think that's where we're headed. When you think, where is a nuclear war going to start? it's not going to start, I don't think, between China and Japan, as much as they hate each other at the moment. I don't think it's likely. They all know that a nuclear war between those two countries will be a disaster for both countries. But the Jews are convinced that they're going to have to use nuclear weapons at some point. The masses of Muslims who have legitimate grievances against them are quite enormous. Without nuclear weapons, Israel will not make it. And from their point of view, I'm sure at some point or other, they're going to decide to use nuclear weapons against Iran or any number of other countries, because Israel by itself is simply not strong enough. The United States may, with conventional weapons, destroy Iran at the request of the Israelis, of course. You know, Netanyahu wants exactly that, and when he comes to America, he basically gives the marching orders to the United States Congress and all the leaders of this country, so that maybe America will do the actual bombing and killing and dying in the coming war with Iran. But even with that, ultimately, Israel will, I think, have to use nuclear weapons on countries like Iran and other countries. So that is a formula for mass extinction of our species, I'm afraid.
You have another article, another link down here about Viktor Frankl. And I remember reading his book, and I thought, oh, gosh, what a brave soul. And he said something, and I can't I had this this quote, I think I carried it in my purse for a while, something that he said that was so significant to me about how to be humane when you are living amongst inhumane treatment, that somehow he survived by being just a better person and not degrading himself and acting like a savage in an environment where it would have been easy to be greedy or to steal other people's food. But I simply cannot remember what it was that I can't
either. Walter Lippel raised this subject with Frankl personally many years ago, and I'm afraid I just can't recall much of the discussion, but Frankl was also one of these frauds, very successful fraud with his tales from Auschwitz, but I don't know enough about it at offhand.
Right, and I've I have his book downstairs, and it's, I just haven't looked.
They're very, very clever.
They are. They say such clever things that make you think,
right.
how brilliant they are. And, of course, when you're young and stupid, things like that sound pretty brilliant. You think, oh, gosh, what a provocative thought. How humane this person was in the face of these filthy Nazis.
right, exactly. Well, guys like Frankl are the ones who are trotted out to get the literary awards, but there are plenty of Jews who were quite outspoken, such as the author of another book that the name of which escapes me, and literally calling for the extermination of the German people before America was even in the war. Kaufman, yeah.
Kaufman.
Yeah. And on my website, Column Right, I have the account of an American physicist, Cohen, who actually invented the a nuclear device, and I can't find it at the moment, but he actually said that he was terribly disappointed that America was not able to drop atomic weapons on German cities during the war. Samuel Cohen, I think that was it.
Yeah,
and
the inventor of the neutron bomb.
The inventor of the neutron bomb, and now I'm sorry, I just can't find it on my website. But it's there,
yeah.
And I may find it as we're talking here, and then I can maybe read something from it. But, oh, yeah, here he is.
Mm-hmm. There he is.
He stated that his only regret was that the bomb hadn't been ready in time to be dropped on Germany. This was a feeling shared by many Jewish scientists, Cohen wrote. Although Germany was spared the nuclear nightmare, what the Western Allies actually did to Germany was bad enough. And this is from Cohen's book. I'll read a little bit of this at least just to give you the flavor of this great American Jewish scientist. I shouldn't exclude his Jewishness here, which is so important to many people.
Sure.
Here's from Cohen. This was particularly true for most Jewish scientists, and there were a lot of them, including Oppenheimer. Many of them were refugees from Hitler, whose friends and relatives had suffered hideously at his hands and who harbored precious little affection for the Nazis. They had a vindictive and even barbaric compulsion to complete the project in time to bomb Germany. Of course, this never happened, and when we finally had a couple of bombs to drop, Germany had surrendered. Trying to throw a little logic into this emotionally supercharged equation, I might say that even if we had finished in time to drop a couple of bombs on Germany, it's far from clear it would have made any real difference on the outcome of the war. By this time, the Allied bombing and shelling of German cities had reduced most of the country to rubble, and it was just a matter of time, a very short time, before the Nazis would have given up. It had become clear to practically everyone but Hitler that the jig was up. Most Germans were in no mood to fight to the bitter end, as many were predicting the Japanese would do. So what might have happened if the atomic bombs that burst over Hiroshima and Nagasaki had landed on Zilchberg in Hinkeldorf? I'd say what happened, undoubtedly, nuclear bombing Germany would have made many scientists at Los Alamos, especially the Jews, including myself, deliriously happy. Well, that, I think, illustrates the obscenity and insanity of Jews in America generally.
Indeed.
And they're ready to do the same thing today against Iran, if they can possibly get away with it, and they are beating the drums for a major war against Iran. And, of course, they have idiots like the senator from Arizona, John McCain, to echo their message and, you know, to shout the message as loudly as he possibly can.
Sure. What about Anne Frank? Somebody wanted to know about Anne Frank and the controversies around her supposed diary.
Well, the diary, there was a diary, I'm sure, but whatever there was rewritten and carefully managed and edited by her father before it was published. And that's more or less been conceded over the years by various people who've been caretaking for this diary. So it's a very silly story. There's nothing in the diary that really incriminates Germany at all. This is a peripheral story to the Holocaust story. At no point in the book does she claim people were gassed or that she was being threatened with gassing or anything like that. So it's off the beaten path, I would say, at this point.
Okay. You mentioned Paul Eisen on your website.
Yeah. He is a Jewish revisionist, I believe, if my memory is correct, and I have considerable respect for him. He's talking, you know, out of the congregation, and I wish him well.
Yeah, I can't imagine how he's getting away with that. I don't know. I've thought of inviting him on the program.
I think it would be well worth having him on your program and listen to what he has to say. I have no doubt that over the years, I've had some contacts with Jews who know that the given legend is bunk. But they themselves are afraid to speak out. If they would say, I'm a Jew and I was there and I saw nothing whatsoever to support these gas chamber claims or mass extermination claims, they would be ruined the same way that Gentiles like me and Germans are ruined in Germany. They would be ruined within their own community. They are afraid, and rightly so, because they are strong witnesses, very strong witnesses against the hoax. I give the testimony of some Jews later on my website. I'll see if I can find them. Gilad Atzmon, I believe, is one.
Oh, yes. I've had him on my friend.
Okay, well, then you know. And I'm sure there are many Jews in Israel who know that the story is basically bunk, but they do not dare to raise their voices. They will be targeted viciously by the Jewish establishment. Mark Lane, actually, who is Jewish and an attorney at the, I hope he's still alive, I'm not sure he is.
I'm not sure.
At the former Spotlight offices and so forth, actually defended the IHR years ago in some important cases and performed brilliantly in court, so much so that the Jewish attorneys on the other side were outraged at him and made threats, various kinds of threats against him. And he stood up like a hero, and he deserves enormous respect for that.
Exactly.
My take on religion, I don't mean to offend anyone, but I probably am, is that religion is bunk. All of it is. And that applies to Christianity as much as Judaism and so forth. Religion basically encourages us to sit in our little corner and hold tenaciously onto beliefs that cannot be defended rationally. And I'm opposed to all of that, regardless of the religion. I'm sure you're a Christian and so forth, and I try to respect people's beliefs, but I can't anymore when I really think about it.
Well, it's when you consider that most of the churches have been infiltrated and they are 501(c) corporations. They are corporations. They do collect money. They do have certain obligations to the big federal corporation called the United States government. Then you have to think, okay, they want to be a 501(c)(3) so that they can retain, so they don't have to pay taxes and whatnot. So, I mean, it's just, it's kind of extraordinary. And I do believe that people should respect others, that they should treat them as they wish to be treated. So I am Christian to the extent that I do. And I have belonged to one church for a good many years. But as far as thinking of the United States as a Christian country is absolutely bizarre. What Christian country is going to do some of the horrific things that this country has done under the banner of Christianity, of going and imposing democracy in some country that would rather be left alone and should be left alone and to do their own thing? So, it's pretty awful.
It is, and all you have to do is look back a few years. Look at what we did in Iraq. You know, Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, but...
No, he wasn't.
Well, okay, I don't want to argue the point as to how bad or good he was, but under his dictatorship, if someone wants to call it a dictatorship, not you perhaps, but under his dictatorship, Christians were relatively safe. Women were protected and had countless opportunities to get higher up in society, and there was relative freedom for education and for advancement. All of that has been totally destroyed right now. In Iraq, you cannot really be a Christian openly if you want to live. The country is a shambles in every sense, and nothing has been improved at all in that country. So,
well, Saddam Hussein is this generation's Adolf Hitler, according to the media, the press, the Jewish-run, Jewish-controlled press. And of course they're going to make him the bad guy, they're going to make him the big bad boogeyman, when in fact, as you say, he was a wonderful, wonderful leader for his country, believed that the resources of that country should belong to the people and not to the Jews, and believed pretty much the same things that Adolf Hitler believed. And you can apply the same thing to...
Except that Hitler was an extraordinary success. One of the reasons why Jews did not just bail out of Germany in 1933 or 34 or 35 or even later was because Germany was an economic powerhouse. Germany, under Hitler, was a fantastic success. They had a miraculously successful economy, even though there was a world depression going on. Mm-hmm. German unemployment was the lowest in the world in 1938,
sure.
At the very time that the United States still had an employment rate that was wavering between 19 and 20% unemployment, 1938 and 39. German unemployment was only 2%. It was the lowest unemployment rate of any country in the world. German factories were producing round the clock, and it wasn't just military equipment. Some of it certainly was, but the German economy was a success. Hitler brought the economy in Germany out of depression. Roosevelt achieved essentially nothing until the war got started, until shortly before Pearl Harbor. Even at the time of Pearl Harbor, I think the unemployment rate in this country was still about 16%. I mean, that was a horrendously high unemployment rate. Germany was a success, and the reason the Austrians were thrilled to be part of Germany was because suddenly they were part of the most successful nation in the world at that time, and their factories and started humming again. They had plenty of work for everyone. In Czechoslovakia, when at least the Czech area was made into a protectorate, the economy boomed. Before that, the economy in the Czech areas was a disaster. They had huge unemployment. Suddenly, the Germans came in, established the protectorate. The Czechs had plenty of work, made money, had plenty to eat, lived far better than they did before the Germans came in, and even far better than the Czechs did afterward under communism and under various
sure.
forms of supposed Czech rule.
Sure.
So these are economic facts that drove events during this period that are hardly ever talked about. The German economy was booming, and German Jews in Germany in 1938 didn't want to leave.
Sure.
That was one of the reasons why the Kristallnacht occurred. It was a pogrom, but it was a pogrom because a German diplomat in Paris was murdered by a Jew. It was a Polish Jew named Herschel Greenspan. And why did he murder a German diplomat? Because Germany had expelled his Polish Jewish parents from Nazi Germany and sent them back to Poland.
That was just temporary. It was temporary kind of a thing. They had to go back.
Well, it was a temporary thing, but the inconvenience of being expelled from Germany was so terrible that he, this young Polish-German, this Polish Jew, was so upset that he murdered a German diplomat.
Leica put him up to that. I think that was
That's very likely, very likely. But
yeah.
You know, but the idea that the Polish Jews were even living in Germany is totally inconsistent with the Holocaust mythology.
Right.
Supposedly, Nazi Germany was a place where Jews were beaten up continually throughout this whole period. Every day, Jews were being beaten up and tortured and what have you.
Sure.
It wasn't true at all. The German Jews were making money. They were doing very well. They had department stores, lots of them.
Sure.
Jewish synagogues were being paid for through the German tax system. You know, if the German government...
they stopped doing that in 1935, and that was one of the things that they were very upset about. But as you say, they were doing very well. They had it better in Germany than the Jews had it in Poland. And what they had to do was go back and just verify their visa, and then
right.
they could come right back into
verify their Polish citizenship so that they
exactly.
wouldn't be stateless Jews living in Germany on the welfare dole in some way or other. So the reality is totally different from the lunacy that we're given. With Danzig, for example, the people of Danzig overwhelmingly wanted to be part of Germany for various reasons. Historically, the people in Danzig, this sort of mini-state that was controlled by international organizations and international law, they didn't want to be part of a economically ruined place like Poland. They wanted to be part of a German state which was booming and prosperous and well-organized and efficient and orderly.
Sure. Well,
and
they were part of that to begin with until
the end of World War I. They were part of that to begin with. That right to be part of Germany was denied to them, totally denied to them, totally withheld from them.
Sure.
The Allies had tried to keep Austria from uniting with Germany as well, but the Austrians...
Austria wanted it.
They wanted, already in 1918, the Austrian Parliament voted unanimously for union with Germany in 1918. And for several years after that, every postage stamp issued in Austria said, not Austria or Österreich, they said Deutsch Österreich. Every postage stamp was surcharged with the marking Deutsch Österreich, German Austria, to let the whole damn world know that Austria wanted to be part of Germany. That was what the overwhelming mass of the Austrian citizens wanted, and that was denied them, even though Woodrow Wilson and his 14 points spoke of self-determination, which sounded so wonderful. The Germans fell for this guy. The Germans think, oh, well, Wilson's offering us these 14 points in which he says people can decide their own destiny and to which country they want to be part of. The Germans believe Wilson, but as soon as Wilson went to Versailles, he was tricked into abandoning that, and the Versailles Treaty was hatched and forced down Germany's throat instead,
right.
leading to World War II.
Now, in getting back to Austria, of course you've heard the crazy, ridiculous statements by Kitty Wurstmann, who said that she was in Austria and how horrible it was when the Germans came in and took over. Have you heard of this woman?
No, I don't know that woman at all.
No, you're not missing too much. She's another person.
Well, I've lived in Austria and I've lived in Vienna, and I think I know something about the mentality in Austria. Most of Austria is as German as any other part of Germany.
Of course, like they speak German and they
right. It's their language and culture, and Americans don't even understand that. Years ago, I had frequent arguments with a colleague who had been a social science teacher in high school. Okay, social science. You know, you would think this guy would know something about European history and the history of World War II and so forth. We had endless arguments about this or that involving Austria and Hitler and so forth. And then one day it dawned on me, this guy is so dumb. Let me ask him a simple question, like, what language do you think they speak in Austria? What language do they speak in Austria, you know? And he said, well, I don't know. I'm sure it's not German, he said. Oh, well, but that's rather typical. And when I told that story again to a few people, all college-educated where I worked at LaGuardia Airport at that time, none of them knew that either. None of them knew that Austria was a German-speaking country, as much German in its history as any other part of Germany. In fact, more German probably than places like Prussia. But Americans, I'm afraid, are so dumb, so ignorant, that, I mean, you have to practically beat them over the head to get anything into them. They have a mental block against knowledge about the world. Zbigniew Brzezinski has talked about this again and again. The ignorance of the American public is a phenomenon.
Well, it's a deliberate dumbing down of the population in order to make them more controllable,
right,
so that they'll either be corporate workers or soldiers.
I mean, if it would be interesting to see how many Americans even know that Germany's biggest enemy in World War II was Russia, and that the United States supported Stalin during the war. Very few, I dare say, would know that, but I don't know exactly what the percentages of that kind of ignorance really are. Do you have any callers?
Nope. Oh no! Let me look in the chat room to see if there's any questions. No questions in the chat room. I don't have any email, but on your website, you talk about a book called Churchill's War, and it talks about Bengal. You have a photo here from 1943, and we talked about other Holocaust. You talked about the Holocaust in Ukraine in 1932-33, where they starved people to death. But we hear very, very little about the 2 million victims from the famine in Bengal in 1943.
Right. That's a minor detail that nobody is interested in talking about. Well, here's a little secret. The British Empire was a thoroughly racist empire. You know, you had the English at the top, and everybody else, especially anyone who had a little bit of shade in their skin, was several steps lower, perhaps a lot of steps lower. It was racism on a worldwide scale, and one shouldn't ignore that today anymore. The subject of racism is all over the place, but the real racists are essentially given a pass, just as the Jews are given a pass. So that is a reality that unfortunately will take probably generations to unravel.
Sure. Some of the things that has happened to other countries because of the ignorance of the American public, the ignorance of the British public. But when you really look at who's running this country, we are a Talmudic country. Let's see, we do have a question from Dave. Is there any reason to have any hope for this country at all, considering the iron grip that the Zog has on us?
I hate to say it, but I don't think there's much reason to hope. I think things are getting worse, and I think we're going to have some kind of a communist type of dictatorship very soon. The Democratic Party I think we might. You may be right. Yeah, the Republican Party has self-destructed, and maybe that isn't even that bad. I think people like Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld are monsters, and get rid of them. But the alternative now is this President Obama, whose real father was an ardent communist agitator. His real father was Frank Marshall.
Right.
Years ago, and here I want to say a few nice things about one of your frequent guests, Veronica Clark. She brought this all to my attention when she published some pictures of Barack Obama next to a picture of Frank Marshall, who was, I think, Obama's real father. Frank Marshall, in that picture, looked exactly like Obama, had this very narrow face, very narrow skull, and all of the same features that Barack has. and totally different from this supposed father that Barack Obama had from Kenya. That Kenya father, I'm sure, had nothing to do with Barack.
Exactly. And his mother's Jewish.
Okay, well, that may be. I wasn't aware of that. But Veronica Clark did an awful lot of great research and did a lot to unearth some of the important facts, and I wish her well. I hope she does more. One of the other things she did was show that Hitler and Nazi Germany had a very friendly relationship with many blacks, and that there were literally thousands of black Africans working for the German war effort in intelligence and various kinds of espionage activities and so forth during the war, and were highly regarded by the German armed forces. And she shows in her book Black Nazis blacks who were actually in German uniforms and fought bravely, as far as we know, for the German war effort. In America, by contrast, blacks were given the most menial and most dangerous tasks, loading ammunition, for example, and sometimes suffering very horrendous casualties when the ammunition exploded. They would do things like drive trucks and so forth, but in general, they were kept out of combat. You know, if the American white guys were running away, then the blacks would be given rifles to try to defend themselves and kill a few Germans. But except for that, the blacks were treated as second and third class citizens. And if they weren't treated that way in the army, they were certainly were treated that way when they got back to America.
Right. You have listed a link, The Last Days of the Big Lie, and this was, and I clicked on it, and it no longer goes to what used to be holocaustdenier.com. And have you talked to our friend lately?
Which one is that?
Eric.
Oh, okay. Yes, I have. And
how's he doing?
Well, I hope he's doing all right. I don't want to tell where he is at the moment.
Oh, no, I don't want to
tell. He's in a very interesting place, and he's working on a video, and I hope something emerges from his project there. He's working on this red color issue, and maybe we'll have a good video one of these days.
Right. And he is the producer of The Last Days of the Big Lie, and he kind of went up against Spielberg.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he uses a video from Spielberg to show how silly Spielberg's claims are.
Sure. But I haven't talked to him for a while. I do need to email him and see how he's doing. And,
Well, I'm sure you can reach him.
He's
on my Skype screen. In fact, let's see if he's on right now. Let's see. He's not online right now. But otherwise, you might have been able to call him while we're...
Yeah, that would have been interesting. I only have his email. I don't have his Skype.
Where is Dave Gahari from?
Dave is in... Where's Dave from? Dave, where are you from?
He's asleep.
Dave is asleep at the wheel.
New Jersey.
He's from New Jersey.
Well, where are you from originally?
New Jersey.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, I'm from New Jersey also, but from New York before that.
Yeah, originally I was born in New Jersey.
But Gahari, that could be Iranian.
I see. My dad was born there and raised there. He came over here when he was 19. And he was not in favor of the Shah's regime there.
Uh-huh.
So they kind of said, "Hey, dude, you better get out of here." So
was he in favor of Mossadegh?
Yes.
Okay, well, that was a good choice, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that was the democratically elected.
Right.
Right. until the CIA took over, right?
Yeah, exactly. So he, you know, he's a smart guy. He knows what's going on. And but he's a regular American. He came here and changed his name and, you know, pulled himself up by his own bootstraps and married an American lady whose father was from Lebanon.
Oh, okay.
And had five kids, and he's still living. He's a good guy, and the American dream, you know.
Well, I used to believe in the American dream also, but I think it's over. I think the young generation today is going to have a tough, tough struggle.
And they won't even know it. They won't even be aware of what has happened to them.
Well, America during my young days was the beneficiary of World War II. During the 1950s and half of the 1960s, America was paradise on earth. It really was. But it did enormously well from the misery of others and from the loot it stole from Germany. Everything that had any technological value in Germany was stolen deliberately by America. There's an excellent book on that subject, but it's too big and too lengthy for most people to even bother with. I have now I can't find it. Let's see if I can. I talk about it in my column right near the bottom. And I may be able to find it as I'm chatting with you.
Okay.
Carlos Porter brought it to my attention. In fact, loaned me a copy to photocopy. It's available online at Amazon.com, and I'm trying to find the author now. Ah, my goodness.
Well, talk about so many things on your website. People spend weeks.
People
just
get lost.
Stuff here.
People get lost. There's so much of it, but I do talk about it. You know, Americans think they invented just about everything after World War II. Today, the story of the transistor came up, and the man who supposedly invented the transistor while he was working at Bell Labs. His name escapes you, but he's very famous. He actually had the benefit of all the technology that was stolen by America, because Bell Labs, as every major corporation, bought entire sets of the copies of all of these CIOS and Fiat reports from the U.S. government. The U.S. government encouraged American companies to use whatever they could from German technology. Here I'm finding some of its stuff, and it's on my column right near the bottom. The author of the book was John Gimbel, and the book is actually, let's see if I can give it here, but it's Gimbel, like the supermarket or like the big department store in New York City. And he talks about these Fiat reports and the CIOS reports, CIOS, and
John Gimbel?
John Gimbel. And the book is available through Amazon.com, but it's not cheap. You may have to pay like $150 for it.
Isn't it amazing that the books that have the most fascinating information in it are always so expensive, but they're worth money?
Well, right, as American troops advanced into Germany, they were accompanied by technical experts,
mm-hmm.
scientists, engineers, technicians, doctors,
right.
to make notes and photograph and copy everything that could be of any technological value here in the United States.
Right.
It didn't just have to be military. Anything that could be of any kind of commercial value, how to make better confectionery sugar, and of course things that made better airplanes like swept wings and computers and so forth. The first electronic programmable computers were in Germany. Germany was far more advanced than any other nation by far in technology for computers. And all of that technology, as well as every other kind of technology, was described as best they could in these various reports. I saw many of them at Columbia University. Columbia University's engineering library was a repository for all of this technology. I could go in any time and thumb through the reports, and I actually stole some of the reports. I figured, why shouldn't I steal some of these reports, since the reports themselves were stolen property? Mm-hmm. And so I have actually some reports describing Auschwitz, for example. The Americans had detailed information as to what was going on in Auschwitz, particularly the petrochemical plant at Auschwitz, and they knew month after month, you know, this part was being expanded, this part was in full production, the other part was still delayed. And
they knew that from aerial...
No, they had ground observers clearly at the same time. So, you know, they had excellent information as to what was going on in Auschwitz. Arthur Butz wrote about this also, and of course he was right. I'm sure he had access to these detailed technical reports as well. And those reports were the basis of some of the bombing of Auschwitz. They didn't bomb the barracks. They didn't bother bombing the crematoria. They bombed the petrochemical plant where the Germans were making synthetic fuel, explosives and things like that. And they knew where to drop the bombs. They didn't just drop them in the general area of the petrochemical plant. They knew, you know, let's drop it here where the boiler is supplying power for practically everything, and where the critical process equipment was, they would bomb there. They had that all figured out well in advance on the basis of detailed espionage, including, of course, aerial reconnaissance. But America had, first of all, great information about Germany, but when the war was actually over, they went into detail everything that could be of value, and they stole it, okay? And that included the technology which led to the transistors. The first prototype transistors actually appeared in Germany in 1947, contrary to the mythology that reigns in America to this day, that William Shockley invented the transistor. But, you know, this is typical of the kind of self-serving propaganda America feeds itself every day, you know, to tell itself that it is exceptional and everybody else is basically stupid compared to America, including Iranians. The Iranians are just dimwits, you know, according to the mentality here today. And,
oh, goodness.
All the more reason to wage a war against Iran and just obliterate them off the planet, right? That's where we're going.
Sure.
I'm joking, of course. You know that, right?
Dave, you know that, right, Dave?
Yeah, I've never been there, but of course I know he's joking.
Do you speak?
I know some curse words.
Oh, God. Well, Iran, I have a good friend here who's Iranian, and he's a very nice guy. He's actually, he's not a Muslim. He's Zoroastrian.
Yeah, that's what my dad adopted, believe it or not.
You know, I suspected that from the way your name was spelled. I'm no expert on Iran, but from your name, it looked like that.
Oh, wow.
I have friends named Afsari and Azari, and your name actually looked Iranian.
Wow. I think it was originally spelled G-H-A-H-A-R-I.
Yeah.
And then they, I guess, Americanized it.
Yeah, that happens.
Well, it used to happen, right?
Well, it happens all the time. It always did, you know, but... Anyway,
what did he write?
We're all under pressure to conform to the perfect, wonderful model that we have in front of us here.
Sure. Now, is that the origins of the Marshall Plan? Is that the one you're talking about?
Well, no, the Marshall Plan was a kind of fraud.
Stole
at least $10 billion worth of technology from Germany. And the $10 billion number is a low ball number. Germany was the technological superpower of the world.
Okay, you have to come up with the name of this book in 90 seconds, Fritz.
Well, look up John Gimbel on Amazon.
I found The Marshall Plan. The book.
And it's on my website. So if anybody wants to look at the bottom of my column right, they'll find it there somewhere.
Or they could email you.
Yeah, they can do that. John Gimbel is the author. I'm sorry.
Well, boy, what a great guest you are, and I really appreciate you being on the program today. It's been delightful having you. It's always wonderful to talk with you.
Well, thank you, and it's wonderful to be on your show.
Indeed, and it's kind of nice, commercial-free, I really like it.
And yeah. It's nice to meet David Gahari as well.
Indeed.
Good luck to you. Good
Likewise.
Luck to you.
Likewise. Hope to talk to you soon, sir.
Right.
All righty. Well, we've got just a few seconds here. And this Marshall Plan book, The Origins of the Marshall Plan, hardcover, get this, $479.06.
Is that the book by John Gimbel?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, no, that's not the book I have in mind. There's another book.
Okay. We'll have to look it up. Thank you so much, Fritz.
Okay. Talk to you later.
All righty. Bye-bye.